All right. The title of the class is called The Morality of Money, and that is something that took a little while to settle on. Actually, there were a handful of titles that had occurred to me because the focus of the class is hard to necessarily define, but we'll do it anyway. The Morality of Money, and the subtitle, A Biblical Understanding of Money, Work, and Stewardship. So we're going to be talking about all those different things related to money, what money is in itself, what work is, why is work important, why is work important, what does work represent, what does money represent, what is stewardship in all of its various forms, stewardship of our money, but stewardship of our resources, other than money, like our talents and time, and even more broadly than that. All of those things come together, and they're all moral. They're all moral, right? And so they all fit together and connect to one another. So we're going to look at how that is the case. On the front of your materials, then, you see the 3 weeks laid out there. Tonight we're going to do an introduction of sorts, what we're talking about, why we're talking about it, and how we're going to approach the basic questions at issue. And that will unfold as we move forward tonight. Next week, we're going to be looking at the moral foundations of economic activity. I'll get there in a second. Economic activity, work, buying, selling, all those kinds of things, there are moral foundations to it. By moral, I mean that there are foundations that govern that kind of activity, that make certain kinds of doing that right in God's eyes and other kinds of doing that wrong in God's eyes. Right? So we got to understand the moral foundations of economic activity. And then in week three, we're going to look at the major economic forces that are at play in any economy, understand what we should do with them, and by the time we get there, you'll understand what we mean by we and what we mean by do with them. Okay, but we're also going to look that week specifically at what the definition, the goal, and the place of charity is, right? Which is a very important topic, and you'll understand why in just a few minutes. So that's our roadmap, and we don't have any time to spare, so we're going to just dive right in at this point, okay? Although, if you have a particular question now, I'd like to address it if possible. I didn't expect so, but it's always good to ask. All right. Week one, an introduction. We are talking about economics. That's what we're talking about. Now, the original title of the class was Biblical Economics. That's what we were going to call it at first. But we were uncertain as to whether that would be clear to people as to what we meant by that, Biblical Economics. Whether people might, first of all, either not understand it at all, or secondly, misunderstand it. So hopefully no one has misunderstood what this class was going to be about, in that this class is not a class about personal finances. Those classes are really good and really necessary, but this is a class which goes deeper than personal finances and examines, as we were talking about already, the foundations, the moral foundations of everything that fits within that world of economics. And that's important. We're already on the why. See how we've already done the what, now we're on to the why. We're just moving right along. I wonder why we have so many pages left. Why that's so important is because so much of life is economic. So much of our everyday activity is related to economics. No matter who we are, we're dealing with it constantly. We're participating in it constantly in all sorts of different ways. And so it's important for us to understand what are the foundational issues here that I'm dealing with in this area of economics. Not only that I'm dealing with personally, or my family is dealing with, or the church is dealing with, or the country is dealing with, but that the world is dealing with in this area of economics. It's at the center of nearly every day of our lives. But secondly, we're talking about this because the days that we live in demand it. The days in which we live really demand, and we'll get to how that is here in a second, they demand that we discuss this, that we engage ourselves in this topic, in understanding the moral foundations of economic activity. It is, I think, in so many different ways, it is the issue of our time. And that perhaps sounds grandiose, but I'm convinced that it's true. A discussion of economics is the issue of our time. I've been interested in economics for a long time. I was a political science major at Calvin, and that's what I got my bachelor's degree in. Always very interested in politics, but not so much the inner workings of I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill part of politics, but the philosophy of politics. What is the state? What is it supposed to be? What is it supposed to do? What is it supposed to govern? All those kinds of things. We've talked about those through the years here in terms of sphere sovereignty and Kuiper's lectures on Calvinism, those kinds of things. We've dealt with those in various ways already. But it seems to me as though the need to understand politics or economics is only getting more and more intense for us due to a few particular factors. One is that we can all see, even just in the sporadic way that we see it on the evening news, the way in which Europe is spiraling out of control. And one day we'll hear, there was a rally on the stock market today because there's a supposed deal in the works in Europe to deal with the debt crisis. And everybody's real positive. I don't know why they get so positive, because the facts of the situation don't change at all. They've just decided they're going to print more money to try to deal with the facts, and suddenly everybody thinks, hey, everything's okay now. We can start to reinvest and get bullish again. And then 2 days later, there's a big drop in the stock market. Why? Well, because the deal fell through. Or there's the idea that the deal might fall through. Okay, so everybody keeps looking to them and wondering what they're going to do about their economic situation, as though our lives are so dependent on what they are going to do economically. And they are, in many ways, very dependent on what they're going to do economically. But secondly, or next, that our own country is in about $16 trillion of debt. Yeah, a lot. Just T-R-I-L-L-I-O-N. I don't know how many. 12 maybe? I don't know. $16 trillion of debt. If you do the math on what a trillion is sometime, just think about how many seconds it is, how many years it takes to do a trillion seconds. I don't have the math with me, but it's a lot. Much more than any of us are going to live. Okay. This is like funny money. And we're in that much debt. It's an issue that our politicians are telling us that we need to deal with, that they're trying to deal with, and we need to understand what's going on there. And within all of this discussion, or parallel to it, and intricately connected with it, there is a constant, and sometimes we see it on the surface, sometimes it's going on underneath the surface, there's this constant debate between and competition between two different kinds of economic systems. One being a capitalist system, and the other being a socialist system. There is constant debate and competition between those two competing systems. But we need to do some defining. And capitalism. When we're talking about capital, now, first of all, as we get into these definitions of capitalism and socialism, you need to know something. And the first thing that you need to know is there's nowhere that you can go and find the definition for either of these things, because there are so many variations. But there are certain things that we can say. And these are some of those things that we can say. A capitalist economy is a free market economy. The market, that is the economic activity that's happening out there in the marketplace, is to a great degree free. That doesn't mean that things are free, that you can just pull off the shelf whatever you want. It means that those interactions aren't being governed necessarily, aren't being directly governed by anyone, but the participants in those economic endeavors are free to do as they're doing. If you want to go sell your product to that store over there, you go right over there and you present your product and you see if you can get a sale, right? That's kind of a free market type idea. But speaking more fundamentally, capitalism, a capitalist economy is where there's private ownership of the means of production. I'll go back and more finally tease this out here in a second. But let me just read it. Private ownership of the means of production, the creation of goods or services for profit or income. That's what people are doing this for profit or income. The accumulation of capital, that means additional profit that you can use to invest in various ways. Competitive markets, voluntary exchange, that's what I was just talking about a moment ago, where it's free. If I want to sell it, I'll sell it. If I think the price is right, then I'm going to get all that kind of thing. And voluntary wage labor. What is paid to you is done voluntarily by the employer. They say, this is how much I am willing to pay. And you, on the other hand, voluntarily accept it. And you say, well, that's how much I'm willing to receive for whatever work it is or whatever service it is or good that I'm going to provide for you. Okay? That's what we mean by a free market. Now, the means of production means that the factories, the farms, the orchards, all of those things are owned by private individuals. Right? It might be a public company, meaning that they sell stock to other private individuals, but all of the money that goes into creating that factory or that business or whatever is held by individual people, private individual people who have voluntarily invested in that. Okay? That's a capitalist or a free market economy. Now, it's very important that we understand that here in a capitalist free market economy, the primary rights in society are held by individuals. The primary rights, and we'll get to what rights are in a minute, the primary rights in society are given by God and held by individuals. These are freely used as it best befits those who hold them. They decide how they are going to use these freedoms. Okay? These rights. Justice, and I'll get to why that has a 3 next to it in just a few minutes. Justice is defined by a protection of those rights for each individual. In other words, in the work that the government does in a free market economy, the way that they maintain justice or do justice is to protect those individual rights. The right to your property, the right that a farmer has to his field and to grow the stuff on his field and to sell the stuff that he grew in his field so that other people don't come by and just take it away from him. Those are protected by the government. Okay? So that's the kind of justice that's put in place to secure the rights that are held by individuals. There we go. Okay, socialism. Socialism is more of a command economy. By command, it means a centralized governing authority makes decisions with regard to the economy. Now, as I mentioned a little while ago, there are variations on each of these things, on a capitalist economy and on a socialist economy. But these things are basically fundamentally true. Instead of private ownership of the means of production, that means the farms, the factories, all that kind of thing, in a socialized economy, there's social ownership of the means of production. Now, what does social ownership mean? It can mean a lot of things. It can mean that the government actually owns everything, like it did in the Soviet Union, right? That was full-blown, all the way to the extreme, kind of a socialist economy. The government owned it all, and the government made all the decisions about what was going to be made, how much of it was going to be made, who was going to get paid, all that kind of thing, right? But it can take other kinds of variations. The government doesn't have to actually physically own these things for the government to still control these things, right? How is it that the government can actually control the means of production even though the government doesn't own the means of production? By regulations, right? If the government regulates what you do, okay? It doesn't have to necessarily own what you do or what you're, the ground that you're working, the factory that you're using, all the materials that you're using. It doesn't have to own those things. If it regulates and then taxes the things that you do, it can, in a certain way, achieve the same result. Okay, that kind of control of the economic activity that's going on. So there's limited private property rights. Sometimes, as in a communist country, there are no private property rights, but it doesn't have to be that extreme. It can be just limited private property rights. Controlled markets, limited freedom of exchange, and more mandated wages, and again, at various levels of various degrees. But what's especially important for us to see is that the primary rights in a socialized society are held by the collective or the state. This is the fundamental difference, okay? That the state holds the primary rights, not the individuals. And that the state then decides to grant those rights to individuals, to certain individuals, as it best befits the collective or the state or the nation or the group of people. Okay? So it's a fundamental difference of perspective. Either the rights exist in the people themselves and the state just tries to protect them, or the rights exist in the collective or the state and the state gives them out as it sees fit to allow people to do certain things that they think should, that the state believes should be done for the good of all. Okay? Justice, then, is defined by a protection of the best interests of the collective or of the whole through a just distribution or redistribution of capital. All right? So the collective, the state, has this idea of what this collective should be like, and then it looks around at the various capital that is available within the collective, and it decides, well, no, this should really be going over there more, and that should really be going over here more. All right? And then they will adjust the rights as needed in order to bring about the end that they believe to be best for everybody. Okay? Is that clear? Does everybody understand? Yeah, a minimum wage would be an aspect of a more of a socialized tenet. Okay? It doesn't, again, because there's a broad range, a spectrum from all the way to, from a fully socialized economy to a fully laissez-faire free market economy, there's all kinds of stops in between, but it certainly is more, because it's more of a socialized idea, because the state is saying, look, if you're going to hire so-and-so, we're going to tell you, you must pay them such and such. Okay? So yeah, that it's more of a top-down kind of thing. Now, let's define what a right is. This is something that we don't often hear about. People often talk, we often talk about our rights, right? We just got done talking about where rights exist in these two different kinds of economies. But what are rights? There are various definitions of rights depending on what area of the law you're talking about. But essentially, with regard to the kind of rights that we're talking about with regard to economic activity, there's two primary kinds of rights. One is natural and the other is legal. A natural right is the sovereign authority to act within a particular area of life or with regard to a particular thing. Sovereign meaning you have the authority and no one can tell you what you must or must not do in that particular area of life. You have the sovereign authority. Those are natural rights, sometimes called inalienable rights. In our country, the right to worship according to the dictates of your conscience, that has been judged to be a natural right. It's based on other natural rights, but no one can tell you who you must worship and how you must worship that deity. You are sovereign there. Now, we all know that ultimately, God is the sovereign, but this understands that he has therefore given these natural rights to human beings. Okay? So they exist with them, that are natural rights. But there are also legal rights, which means that you have the legal authority to act or to have others act on your behalf. And that's a very significant difference. And it plays into a lot of the discussions that are had with regard to whether there should be a right to this or a right to that. If you believe in that only natural rights define ultimate justice in what should or should not be done, then, for example, you do not believe that you could even have a right to have someone else have to do something for you. Because that now is placing a demand on somebody else that they must do something for you. And if you have that right and they have that right, where does that end? What am I really entitled to? One way of thinking would say, what we're really entitled to is to our natural rights. Now, sometimes we place legal rights in place for other kinds of reasons. For example, you have a legal right to vote. Everybody has a legal right, but not everybody. If you're 18, if you're a citizen, all those kinds of things, those are legal rights. There's a place for legal rights. But when we're talking about economic activity as such and the governing of economic activity, the distinction between natural rights and legal rights is an important one, as we'll see later on when we get into some of the more specific areas where the distinctions between these two ways of doing things become clear. But I mentioned a little while ago that we have, whenever you've seen the word just or justice so far, there's been a little one, two, or three next to it. And that's because what you find is you begin to get dizzy when you're reading various things that people are saying, this is just, or that is just, or we're for justice in this situation, and we're for justice in that situation. What do you mean by just? What do you mean by justice? Right? Hopefully this will help us in sorting through that. The first idea of just is the way things ought to be. So if you're saying a really just economy would be an economy where, and then you just fill in the blank. And what you're really saying is the way that things ought to be is, and then you define that. That would be the best situation, that would be the most just, or you might use the word fair situation, to have. That's one way of thinking about what is just. But there's a second way of thinking about that which is just, and it has more to do with activity. What is just activity? What are just actions? So that second way of speaking of justice is private actions that are taken in compliance with either moral or natural law. Now, let me explain that. If you steal somebody else's purse, we say that that is an unjust action. Why do we say it's an unjust action? Well, because it is an action taken which breaks moral law that God has given that you should not steal. It also happens to break legal law or laws that have been set up, civil law, that is. But we know it to be an unjust act. We have to be able to identify what are just acts and what are unjust acts. And that is another way of speaking of this kind of idea of justice. Any action that is done in accordance with the moral law, that is the law of God, or of natural law, and we'll talk about that, what natural law is in just a minute, those would be just actions, and other kinds of actions would be unjust, right? But there's a third way of thinking about this idea of doing something that's just or bringing justice, and that is public action, normally done by the state. And it's normally punitive. That means it's punishing people for various things. Not always. Sometimes it's just setting up regulations or laws. But oftentimes it's punitive, punishing people, which seek to establish or protect that first idea of justice or the second idea of justice. In other words, they say, maybe you say that the way things ought to be is that everybody's property ought to be kept secure. That's part of the way things ought to be. But Bill just broke just definition number two by coming and taking my wife's purse. So the state comes in and does an act of justice, that third definition, to punish Bill, bring the purse back, and have Bill pay the consequences, all right? And by doing so, it's reestablishing the way things ought to be by bringing back what belongs to my wife and hopefully warning others not to take similar kinds of actions, okay? But we need to, as you go through and as we read various things, whether it's things that that I've prepared as part of these materials or that come from other places, we need to be thinking about the difference between these things. And the reason that we need to think about these things is very important. When we went on the DR trip last time, we ordered shirts from the CRWRC, I believe it was. Is anybody here that was part of that? Anyway, the shirts came, and on the back it said, "Doing justice, loving mercy." I don't know if they finished the verse and walking humbly with our God or not, but the idea was doing justice, right? What do you think of when you hear doing justice? First of all, that's not the way the verse goes. It says doing justly or doing that which is just, which would be item number two, right? In other words, I'm only going to take actions that are morally just. But when you hear doing justice, which of those three definitions does that sound more like? Number three, right? In other words, I'm going to come in here and I'm going to make things right, but we don't have that kind of authority. That's the authority that the state has to bring justice, to try to reestablish the way things ought to be. So, but there's a way of thinking that tries to take on individually that third idea of justice, and that becomes a problem in the way that we construct rules and laws with regard to economic activity. This hopefully will be pieced together as we go along. For any of you who are going, what? Hang with me, because all these things are going to, that individually they'll take more form as we go along, and they'll also be connected to each other more as we go along. But do you understand the difference between those three definitions? It's an important distinction to make, and so we're going to be making that distinction as we go along, because we run into this word justice all the time, and it's going to be helpful for us to be able to make distinctions that we have to make. So, also, one of the reasons why we are doing this study is because our nation has been embracing more and more of a collectivist ideology or a socialist ideology for a long, long time. It really goes back at least 100 years in our nation, with in the early 20th century with the progressive movement. But it has been accelerating in recent years. The Great Society programs of the 60s certainly were a centerpiece of that transition, and LBJ's War on Poverty, but also the Affordable Care Act that was just passed a couple of years ago, the Health Care Act. One of the biggest questions about that act was, does the government have the authority to force people to make economic decisions? Right? They said, well, that's what's at the Supreme Court right now. All these states got together and said, wait a minute, the government can't force you to buy something. Well, why would they say the government can't force you to buy it? Well, because we do not have a socialist in that kind of, by definition, the Constitution isn't a socialist document that gives the rights to the government, and then they simply dole them out as they feel necessary. Those rights exist in the individuals. So how can you force individuals to take action in an area where they have sovereignty, where they're supposed to be the people who decide these things? Okay? And that now has expanded, that difficulty has expanded with the recent decisions about forcing people not just to buy the insurance, but forcing them to pay for procedures or to pay for premiums that go to procedures that they don't believe in. Okay? So once you begin to encroach on those freedoms and say, no, we're going to force you to do this economically, then it just continues to... So the question that we need to ask is, where has the line been crossed? Has the line been crossed simply with this issue of religious freedom and forcing people to do something that they don't believe is right religiously? Or has the line been crossed previously by forcing people to do these things regardless of what the purpose is, okay, or what the specific issues are at stake? This has also come out in recent polling. The Pew research firm, the Rasmussen group, and Gallup in the last 2 to 3 years, all of their findings seem to coincide that only 52 to 53% of people in our nation are positive about capitalism when they're asked about it, while 37 to 40% view socialism positively. And among the young, 18 to 30 years old, it's roughly split evenly between those who prefer capitalism and those who prefer socialism. Now, one of the caveats to those studies is none of the studies defined what capitalism was and what socialism was. But they do show a trend, at least, that socialism, at least the name, the word, the label socialism, is growing more popular, certainly than it used to be. Perhaps it's because people don't really understand as much about what socialism is, or because they are linking capitalism with Enron, right? Or major banks that receive bailouts, or those kinds of things, right? But for one reason or another, this transition seems to be happening. But it's not just happening in the political world around us, it's also happening in the church around us. We discussed this a little bit when we talked about the Belhar Confession and the kinds of things that we saw embedded in the Belhar Confession that later became much more clear and obvious in what's called the Accra Confession, right, which came out about 8 years or so after the Belhar Confession came out. The Accra Confession is a confession. You have to understand that the Accra Confession, this is not just some strange religious group from some other country that came up with this idea and is trying to push it on other countries. The Accra Confession grew up in the Reformed churches, just like the Belhar Confession did. Grew up in the Reformed churches, specifically the Accra did. And what it does is it makes belief in a socialized economic system a tenet of the Christian faith. It says in various places, this is in its introduction, it says justice is a matter of faith. Now, what justice are we talking about? See how confusing this becomes already? Justice is a matter of faith. Which justice? The way things ought to be? Just activities? Or the role of the state in bringing about the way we think things ought to be? Okay, which of those are we talking about here? Well, it gets clearer as you go forward. The Accra Confession states that matters of economic and ecological justice, again, what kind? Are not only social, political, and moral issues, they are integral to faith in Jesus Christ and affect the integrity of the church. Being faithful to God's covenant requires that individual Christians and the churches take a stand against current economic and environmental injustices. Okay? And that word injustice must mean, well, it doesn't, no. You'd think that it would mean activities that are happening that are unjust or unjust, our definition number two. But what it really seems to mean is things that are going on that make things not the way we think they ought to be. Right? Creating a situation that's not our understanding of what justice, economic justice, really ought to look like. The filling in of the blank where we'd say the way things really ought to be is. Okay? What we see going on isn't producing the way we think things ought to be. Anyway, this is an issue of faith. It then says paragraph 25, therefore we reject any ideology or economic regime that puts profits before people, does not care for all creation, and, get the phrase, and privatizes those gifts of God meant for all. What does that mean? What gifts of God are they talking about here? Well, they're talking about the raw materials that are owned and put into use, either by making something out of them or constructing something out of them and then selling it. That these gifts, which some people are profiting from, really don't belong to them. They belong to everybody. Okay? But they're making a killing on these things, and really, all these things belong to all of us altogether. We reject any teaching which justifies those who support or fail to resist such an ideology in the name of the gospel. That is, the gospel itself says you must oppose, and you see what they're really saying is you must oppose a free market economic system according to the gospel. Okay, it's a tenet of the faith. It says in classical, now what is it trying to, what kind of economic system is it talking about? It says in classical liberal economics, now one of the things that you have to notice, the meaning of the term liberal has changed. It's really done a 180. Okay? Classic liberal economics is what we would know to be free market economics. Okay? But in terms that, in the way that the term liberal is used today, we think that's completely the opposite, right? But this is classically liberal. It means free market, right? In classical liberal economics, the state exists to protect private property and contracts in the competitive market. That's what we've already talked about, right? The role of the government is to protect the rights that are given to individuals. Through the struggles of the labor movement, states began to regulate markets and provide for the welfare of people. Okay, we've got a switching now, that the government is starting to provide for people rather than just protecting the rights that they have. Since the 1980s, through the transnationalization of capital, neoliberalism, they're just calling what, that's the term that they give to the modern day free market perspective, has set out to dismantle the welfare functions of the state. Under neoliberalism, the purpose of the economy is to increase profits and return for the owners of production and financial capital, while excluding the majority of people and treating nature as a commodity. That is, nature, or the raw material, something that can be bought and sold. Neoliberal economic policies include privatization of services, such as education, water, and healthcare, privatization of those things. Deregulation, which often results in reduced rights and protections for workers and the environment. Reductions in government spending on social programs, such as education and erosions in the safety net for the poor, the free flow of investments, products, and jobs, but typically not persons, across national borders without restraint, and increased trade. Neoliberalism, or what we know to be a free market understanding of economics, is, by the writers of the Accra Confession, judged to be fundamentally contrary to the Christian faith. So if you ask the question, or if anybody else might ask the question, why would we be talking about this? Why are we dealing with this issue? Why is it so important for us to sort it all out? That is one of the main reasons why it's so important. Set aside the fact that the European economic system is spiraling out of control for the most part. Set aside the fact that our own nation is $16 trillion in debt. Set aside all those things, the church, and the church that this, by the way, the Accra Confession was essentially proposed by WORC, which is the World Alliance of Reformed Churches, of which the Christian Reformed Church is a part. These things are on our doorstep. And they are saying that it is a fundamental belief of the Christian faith that the government should be providing these things for people. Essentially, then, what it's saying is that rights exist with the state, and that the state is supposed to grant, issue those rights as it seems fit or deems necessary for the good of everyone, for the good of the whole. And that, obviously, then, would be for the goal of, as they indicate, the taking care of the poor. So within the church, then, the question becomes defined this way. If you are really a Christian, you must be concerned with the poor. And to that, we would answer, amen. But if you're really concerned with the poor, you necessarily must embrace socialism. That is, without a doubt, the argumentation that's being brought forth by the writers of the Accra Confession and many other people in the church who feel the same way. To do otherwise is not to be a Christian. And, incidentally, at the recent prayer breakfast, the president essentially said the same thing. Because he said, as a Christian, he's talking about his proposed raising of more taxes from the rich in order to help those who are in difficult times. He said, as a Christian, it also coincides with Jesus' teaching that for unto whom much is given, much shall be required. Right? He's giving a Christian argument for the redistribution of wealth, which is the taking of wealth or property from certain people and giving it to others. And that is, more and more today, what is defined as charity. So these are the issues of our times. Where do we stand on that question, and why do we stand there? What do we think about that? Is that true? That's a very important question for us because we need to know what's true. This is a critical question for us to know the answer to, especially today, because our stance on these matters is going to be a public profession of God's truth. Wherever the church stands on this particular question is going to be a public profession of what God stands for. So we better get it right. But in order to get it right, we need to understand economics from a biblical perspective. And that's what we're going to seek to do in this class. And when I say a biblical perspective, I mean a Reformed hermeneutic perspective, right? Where you got the big picture, but the big picture is made up of all these little specific teachings in Scripture. Teachings which do not, in a real way, contradict each other. There might be sometimes an apparent contradiction, but then you need to dig a little deeper and see how those two things actually do coincide, and they actually enhance one another. What this means, then, is that as we go through this issue, what far too often happens is that people on both sides of this issue, they grab a few different passages, and they bring them over here, and they say, see, the Bible teaches this. And the other side takes a few of the passages and says, no, 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 the Bible teaches this. And there's this huge gap between what the Bible essentially ostensibly teaches. But what we need to do is we need to take all of these passages that have to do with economic activity, including charity and work and stewardship and all those things, and come up with what is genuinely a biblical understanding of economics, of economic activity. Because when we get to that, we'll understand what moral conduct in economics is and what it isn't, what we should be standing for and what we shouldn't be standing for, and why. So, question number one, then, that we've come to, the first central question that we have to deal with is there a clear biblical position to be found in matters of economics? Because some might say there's not. And if there's not, then there's no reason for this class, well, except to get to the end and say, okay, there's no clear biblical definition, so every man or woman for themselves on this one. Okay? Is there a clear biblical position to be found on matters of economics related to making a choice between the basic tenets of capitalism and that of socialism? Is there a fundamental moral superiority of one system over the other? Moral superiority. Not even necessarily economic superiority. Is there one that has moral superiority? If there is, we need to understand what it is, how each aspect of it is designed to enhance the glory of God, and then preach it, teach it, and live it. And it seems to me that there is great reason to believe that there is, in fact, such a biblical understanding or definition or position on these matters. And the reason for that is because economic questions are always moral questions. And I want to speak categorically there. Every economic question is, by definition, a moral question. No matter what you are considering doing that has anything to do with economics, there are moral issues at stake. And by moral, I mean that God has a perspective on what kinds of things would be right or wrong. But all moral questions are biblical questions. That is, if you want to understand what kind of activity with other individuals is moral or right or just, and what kind of activity is immoral, not right, or unjust, where are you going to go? You have to go to the Scriptures. And that's what we have to insist on. And because I have run into people who, with every fiber of their being, they believe that one of these systems is more right than the other. But they don't necessarily want to go back to the Scriptures to define what is right and what is wrong. As though there were some other morality that existed in the universe with regard to economic activity between individuals, to govern its morality, that is, other than God's morality. And if you look at God's law, there's all kinds of things there that have to do with economic activity. Not just stealing or coveting that which you later decide to steal, but all kinds of other things as well, as we'll see here in just a little while. And would any of us, in addition to what we've already said in with regard to this particular question of, is there a biblical position that helps us choose either toward the capitalist basic tenets or the socialist basic tenets, would any of us actually make the case that God is not concerned about such things? That God's not concerned about our economic activity or the reasons why we do one thing or another, buy one thing or another? Or, in addition to that, would any of us like to find ourselves on the opposite side of God with regard to these things? I take that as a very serious question. Now, if there were such a biblical position, teaching, that clearly directed us in one direction or the other, and we disregarded it and held on to our own beliefs anyway, what would that say about us? If you were a staunch capitalist, and yet you could be shown that there was a clear biblical position which pointed us in the direction of a socialist economy, and yet you continued to hold to your capitalist understandings, what would that say about you? I'm not saying that you haven't been convinced that there's a biblical position, that you can't see it. I'm saying that you can see it, that it's been demonstrated to you that there's this clear biblical position. What would that say about you? Well, it would say about you just what people do say about you. That no matter what reasons you give to support your belief in a capitalist system, those reasons are only veiling the reality of your greed. That really down deep, you hold to a capitalist understanding of economics because you like having what you have and you don't want to share it. That's what we'd have to say, wouldn't we? If it could be demonstrated from God's word, and yet we held to a capitalist understanding anyway. But what about the other way? What would it say about us if a clear biblical position could be found that pointed us in the direction of the basic tenets of a capitalist economic system, and yet we continued to hold to a personal affinity for a socialist system anyway? What would that say about us? Because it has to say something about us, just like the other thing would say something about us. What would it say about us? Well, it would be something sinful, right? Because the other situation said something sinful about us. Anytime we reject what God's word clearly shows, there's something sinful going on. What would it be? In this case, I think the case could be made that what's really going on here, no matter what kind of reasoning you give for why you would continue to hold to that socialist understanding or belief in a socialist type economy is that underneath there's some latent jealousy or covetousness for what other people have. You don't want them to have it or so much of it. The point is, first we have to know whether or not the Bible says something clearly on this issue or not. If it doesn't, we can all go home and go on our own separate directions. But if it does, then we have to adapt ourselves to it. And we have to advocate for it. Because whatever God stands for is going to be to the benefit of everyone. And that's something we take both by experience and by faith. And aside from that, the fact is that there is a wealth, pun intended, there is a wealth of biblical material on this issue. And as I already talked about, both sides know that. They grab it. There's a wealth of biblical material on this issue, and it's used by both sides. So we need to use a Reformed hermeneutic to try to pull all of those things together. How can all of these things be true at the same time? What is their proper place in an understanding of what a God-honoring economic system looks like? So, my opening contention or assertion. Contention sounds so contentious, doesn't it? I don't want to be contentious, but I want to be assertive. So whatever word we want to use there. My opening assertion or contention is that while many Christians do disagree on issues of economics, they should not. They should all agree. We should all agree. And I know that that is not conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom is that this is not one of those issues where we're all supposed to agree. I disagree. But I'm not alone. Because in my experience, every single solitary person, Christian, that I know of, that's got a perspective on this, one way or the other, believes that their perspective is the one that everybody should have. So I'm not alone. All of us feel that way. Why do we feel that way? We're going to answer that question here in just a minute, hopefully. My second contention is that if our concerns in the area of economics are genuinely righteous, then we will be confirmed in our righteousness when we are finished with this class. Let me tell you what I mean by that. If you or anybody who happens to be listening on tape finds themselves way over here, and let's just say that this is the socialist side, okay? Finds themselves over there. And they find themselves over there not because they're overrun with covetousness or jealousy, but because they genuinely believe that this is loving, okay? In other words, their reasoning for standing here is a righteous one. And this person over here is standing here because they genuinely believe that their capitalist understanding of the economy and the basic tenets of it are righteous. That in the end, when we have a good definition of what a fundamental biblical position on a moral and just economy is, both of them will be confirmed in that. In other words, the things that they find so righteous about this position and the things that they find so righteous about this position are going to come together. Okay? So we can all have a righteous position together. This is what I mean by we shouldn't disagree on this issue. Because any righteous reasonings that someone would stand here are not in conflict with the righteous reasonings why someone would stand here. It's the unrighteous reasons that someone would stand here or that someone would stand here that are in conflict. I want to go back for just a minute to the idea that, you know, maybe I'm wrong about that assertion that we all should agree, that we all really need to agree in this area. Couldn't we say, Pastor John, that this idea of economics falls in what we might call the disputable matters, right? We know that the Bible says that there are things, certain issues, that are disputable. And what the Bible means by that is that the rightness or the wrongness of a particular action is determined more by the perspective or the reasoning of the person doing it than by the action itself. Now, the Bible does talk about those kinds of things, but the list of disputable matters in the Scriptures is pretty small. One of the places that deals with that is Romans 14, and we're not going to read the passage. It's somewhat lengthy, but it essentially identifies two things. It doesn't say that this is an exhaustive list, so it might not be exhaustive, but it identifies two main things that would be in that category of disputable matters, which means that I might have a particular belief about it, which is different than your particular belief, but we can agree to disagree, and we can still be brothers and sisters in Christ. Food is one of those things. Whether you believe that certain foods you should not eat, and that your abstaining from those foods gives glory to God and it's what He wants you to do, that's between you and God. And Paul says, don't try to make anybody feel guilty because they either do eat it or they don't eat it. Because the action itself isn't moral or immoral. It's the reason they do it that's either moral or immoral. So if the reason that they eat that meat is because they know that every gift has been given by God and they give thanks to God for every delicious bite, then don't tell them they can't do that. However, if someone abstains from that because they believe that God would have them not eat that kind of thing, then don't tell them that they have to eat it. That's a disputable matter. Be brothers and sisters. Don't think that your belief has to be everyone else's belief. Another one is days. That is holy days. And he says some people observe these holy days and they do so to God. Other people treat every day the same and they do that to God. But if you're one of those people who believes in these holy days and that you have dedicated these days to God and you're going to treat them differently than other days, great. You go right ahead and do that. That will glorify God. But don't tell every other believer that they have to do that too. And just the opposite as well. Okay? That's what disputable matters are. We can agree to disagree. The action itself isn't moral or immoral. It's my perspective in taking that action. But there are some guidelines that Paul gives about these things. First of all, whatever you happen to think, keep it to yourself. That's one of the guidelines. Secondly, do not become a stumbling block for those who feel differently. So if you know that your brother, or you suspect that your brother might believe that eating meat sacrificed to idols is a sin, then don't eat meat sacrificed to idols in front of him, because he doesn't know that you're doing it freely because God gives every gift. He doesn't know the perspective of your mind and heart in that. In his mind, that's still connected with that God, and to do it would be a sin against the true God. So don't lead him into that. Don't, by example, lead him along into taking actions that are really contrary to his conscience. And when he takes them, he says, oh, I know this is a sin, but I guess I saw my brother do it, so somehow it must be okay. Don't be a stumbling block. But also, and part of what I just said is, defer to the weaker brother when you're together. So in other words, you have to accommodate what you really believe to what your brother really believes when you're together so that you won't risk leading them into sin. But issues of economics don't fall into that category. They simply do not fit the description of the disputable matters because it's impossible to keep these things to yourself. Why is it impossible to keep these things to yourself? Well, because we've already said that every decision about economic activity is inherently moral. It's all inherently moral. In addition to that, all economic activity is relational. In other words, you can't keep it to yourself, certainly not in practice, because economic activity is relational. You're doing it with other people all the time. In addition, as we've already seen, all questions about economics and the morality of economics deals with the issue of justice. What is just activity? And what is unjust activity? So we're obligated to speak out about those kinds of things. So it's impossible just to agree to disagree. It cries out for advocacy. Even the biblical text cries out for advocacy about these things, to speak for justice, for what really should be happening in society. Right? So these moral guidelines or rules that regulate economic activity are hold for each one of us. There's nothing inherently moral or immoral about eating meat. But there is something inherently immoral about stealing what belongs to your neighbor. And all sorts of other issues that relate to economic activity. False weights and measures, for example. No, we've never had any problem with the vehicle. It's a Chery. Right? Because you know that if you tell them what might really be wrong with the vehicle, it's not going to sell. So yes, shade the truth a little bit. Is that a moral decision? Yes. Is it a moral decision for everyone? Yes. And economic activity is filled with these kinds of things. It's moral from beginning to end. So our differences of opinion here and here can only be explained by four possible causes. One, God is not clear about such things. Okay? So we might look through the Bible and yet find that he really hasn't been that clear. His word is not sufficiently clear to conclusively establish his will in matters of money and economics. So if he has a position, we don't know what it is. Or his word is only sufficient to conclude certain things in this area, and the rest is left up to us to sort out. Now, that's always going to be true to some degree, but what I'm talking about here is I'm talking about the basic fundamental foundations that will point us either toward a more free market kind of economy as a moral one, or toward a socialist economy as a moral one. That he really hasn't fully explained that to us, only given us a few of the basics, and it's up to us to sort that out. Because the next step is that only people then who are really in tune with God can know for sure which of these two he would rather have us advocate for and stand for. Secondly, God does not care about such things. He's not just not been clear, he doesn't care. Maybe he doesn't care, we think, because these things are of a different kingdom. You know, he said, if my kingdom were of this world, then I could, you know, call the angels or my disciples, would fight for me, but it's not of this world. And say, his kingdom is not of this world, therefore he doesn't care about these things. These things are profane, and they should be shunned by his people as much as possible. In other words, money and economic activity is only a necessary evil for our living in this world. And so he really doesn't care. Three, we are not clear about what his word has to say about such things. Even though he might be, we're not clear. And we're not clear maybe because we haven't been taught well. Or we've misunderstood things that we have read. That is, that we haven't taken a truly reformed approach to the question, seeing how all the pieces fit together in a unified whole. Or maybe we just have never gone about applying ourselves to this question. So it might be that he does speak clearly. We just are unclear because we haven't taken the time to examine the question. Or, fourthly, we don't care what he has to say about these things. He might have a clear position. It might be in his word. But quite frankly, I don't care. We might think that way because we really don't think these things are essentially morally moral. That there's nothing necessarily moral or immoral about them. Or we could say that even if he had such a position in his word, that his word was written so long ago and to such a different world that it cannot be applied today. And so while we can get a couple of basic fundamentals from his word, we have today, than what people had in the past. But none of those four reasons are good reasons as to why there should be differences of opinion about such things. Because we have no excuse if we haven't applied ourselves. We certainly don't have an excuse if we think that these things are not moral somehow, or if with his word and the basic fundamental truths, foundational truths of his word, doesn't care about such things. We can find 1,000 different examples of economic activity that we would have to say, of course, God cares about these things. The first one is yet to be determined. Does he have a conclusive case? Has he laid it out in his word for us? We don't know yet. But maybe that's because we haven't applied ourselves. So, anyway, let's carry on with finding out. Question two. Question one was, does God have a fundamental or a comprehensive case in his word that can point us in one direction or the other? We're going to assume right now that he does, that it's worth checking, that these things are moral, that he's a moral God, and we're going with all those reasonings to say, we got a clue that given the amount of material in his word, he cares about it, and if we spend the time, we can put all those pieces together. But moving on to question two, is there a biblical connection between morality and prosperity? You say, okay, let's just say that we're going to go about trying to add up all these individual teachings on money and economics and the morality of various kinds of economic activities. How are we going to go about making sense out of all of it? Where are we going to start to try to figure out what brings them all together? What are some of the basic starting points to make sense out of all those pieces? I believe that the basic starting point is with this question: is there a biblical connection between morality and prosperity? And if there is, how does it change the nature of our investigation? Our investigation, again, is trying to tell us, is there a case that can be found to clearly point us here or clearly point us there, right? The first question we have to ask is there a biblical connection between morality and prosperity? In other words, between being prosperous and being moral. Is there a biblical connection between those two things? Well, let's look. Why do we want to ask that question? First of all, because prosperity is what both sides claim to be working for. Right? Both sides claim to be working for prosperity, and not just for prosperity, but both sides claim to be working for prosperity for all. But for both sides to be working for prosperity assumes that they're saying prosperity is a good thing. Doesn't that have to be a basic belief? If both sides are saying we want there to be prosperity for the most number of people possible, that they would be saying, by definition, that prosperity is a good thing. Is prosperity a good thing? Well, we don't always treat it like a good thing. Should our goal be prosperity for all, or something more like provision for all? While there are many people who are more in the socialist camp who would say, well, they want prosperity for everybody too. They just believe in getting there a different way. When pushed, they might say, and we'll find this out in a little while, hopefully, they might say, well, that's not exactly what I mean. I mean provision for all, that everybody ought to have what they need to have. Okay? But we've got to think about that, the difference between provision and prosperity. And is one of these more moral than the other? That may sound like a really crazy question, but that's an incredibly important question. Is working for prosperity for all a more moral goal than working for provision for all? Or is working for provision for all a more moral goal than working for prosperity for all? That's a great one. I can see that you think so too already, right? You might have no idea what I'm talking about. But that's an incredibly important question. What should we think that the economic system should be seeking to provide for people? Prosperity or provision? We're not going to answer it now. But put a star next to it, because that's going to be one of the central questions that we have to answer as we go forward. Is one of them more moral than the other? So why are we asking this question? This question of is there a biblical connection between morality and prosperity? Not only because both sides claim to be working for prosperity, and if so, if there's a biblical connection between morality and prosperity, and we're trying to work toward prosperity, then we'd want to be instituting those moral things that bring prosperity. Also, asking this question helps us to make some necessary distinctions so that we can accurately answer the other questions we have. The main question that we have, we need to make some more distinctions. We already made some distinctions in the word just, and those are going to be helpful for us, continue to be helpful for us as we go along. But making good distinctions is so critically important when dealing with a morass like this. Okay? Making good distinctions, because people can be very slick with their words and they can blur distinctions that make a case that shouldn't be made. Anyway, there's two different ways that we can think about this question of whether or not there's a connection between morality and prosperity. One of them is to start from the back and work your way this way. In other words, to say, this person happens to be prosperous. Does the fact that this person happens to be prosperous say anything about their morality? Is a prosperous person, by definition, a moral person? Don't think so? Okay. Is a prosperous person, by definition, an immoral person? Okay. What about an impoverished person? Is an impoverished person, by definition, a moral person? Is an impoverished person, by definition, an immoral person? Okay, what are we saying? What we're saying is we can't jump to the end and know the beginning. That is, we can't know whether there's moral, something moral here or something immoral here just by looking at whether there's prosperity or impoverishment. That's very important. So that when you look at a person and they're prosperous, you don't know. They could be moral. They could be immoral. You can't tell. But so too when you look at an impoverished person. They might be moral or immoral. You don't know. That doesn't tell us anything. So we can't go from the back door.